want a man in a Buffalo. I don't want a man in Kansas City. I want a man in a Ohio. I don't want a man in a Mississippi. They want me in Oceania. Wherever you may look tonight, you will see this wanted man. I might be in Colorado or Georgia by the sea, working for some man who may not know at all who I might be. If you ever see me coming and you know just who I am, don't breathe a word to no one, buddy, 'cause I'm a wanted man. Wanted man in Albuquerque. Wanted man in Syracuse. Wanted man in Tallahassee. I'm a wanted man in Baton Rouge. Wanted man. Wanted man in a Galveston. Wanted man in a El Dorado. This wanted man's in great demand. If you're here, I catch me sleeping. You see the price flash above my head. Take a look again, my friend. That's a gun pointed at your head. Wanted man by Lucy Watson. Wanted man by Jesse Brown. Wanted man by Nellie Johnson. Wanted man in our next town. Wanted man by the Bourne sisters. Wanted man by Kate Callahan. Hey honey, don't you tell me you don't want me, 'cause I'm a wanted man. Or broken man who lost his will to live. Or haunted man. Pushing daisies in the ground. Wanted man in the Windy City. Wanted man in Tennessee. Wanted man in a broken arrow. Wanted man in a wounded knee. Wanted man in a Jackson town. Wanted man in El Paso. I got bounties on my head in towns I would never think to go. Devil comes collecting, 'cause there ain't no wanted man. He better wear a six gun on his hip and hold another in his hand. If you love the wanted man, you best hold him while you can, 'cause you're gonna wake up one morning and find the man you want and he is gone. Wanted man in a New York City. Wanted man in San Antonio. Wanted man down in Laredo. Wanted man in a Cupertino. Wanted man in the state of Texas. Wanted man in the state of Maine. This wanted man's in the state of Leland. You better jump in on a midnight train. Wanted man.
Tonight's symposium will be a device of manifold containment, a double-bottomed double feature, or should I rather say a half feature, as you will only listen to the first part tonight. And as we are desperately seeking exposure to the background noises of the past, tonight we will introduce and then listen to Eric Bentley's commentary on Bertolt Brecht's deposition before the House and American Activities Committee on October 30th, 1947. Bentley's comments date from 1963. Now, those who live on the black surface of a vinyl record don't realize how strange it is for the living to be taken without preamble inside the thick atmosphere of a recording that is as recent as our father's year of birth and at the same time old enough to be considered a documentary fable. If the label wasn't, as Charles Maravich once put it, mealy-mouthedly inadequate, we would call Bentley's piece a Brechtian docudrama. This is, at any rate, our tribute to Eric Bentley. For those who are not familiar with the figure and work of Eric Bentley, I will say that he was born in 1916 and that he's still alive as we record these pages. A British-born American, Eric Bentley met Bertolt Brecht while teaching at UCLA in 1942. Brecht had established himself in Santa Monica at that time, and Bentley was maybe already incubating what would become his first manifesto, The Playwright as Thinker. Later, he not only launched his career as a hard-boiled critic and a playwright, but also as a stage performer and singer, a thinker with many hats, all of them double-bottomed. Brecht and Bentley became friends, and Bentley translated some of Brecht's plays and closely followed the reception of his work by the American scene. In 1963, after Bentley had published In Search of Theater and What is Theater, the Folkways label released an extraordinary document edited and annotated by Bentley, Bertolt Brecht's appearance before the HUAC in the morning of October 30th, 1947. In a few moments, Eric Bentley himself will properly introduce this priceless document that anybody can buy on the internet just as I did. But let me add that in 1963, 64, and 65, and in parallel to the appearance of Bentley's book, The Life of the Drama, three other Folkways records came out, the first one featuring the play A Man's a Man, directed by Bentley, the second and third presenting poems and songs written by Bertolt Brecht and performed by Bentley himself. Thenceforth, he appeared as the critic cum cabaret singer we so much admire, introducing his own performances and his healthy defeatism in a way that, for totally personal reasons, remind me of Johnny Cash during his concert at San Quentin. Allow me a digression. Maybe I have this feeling because Wanted Man is, at any rate, a fully Brechtian song. And this, despite the fact that I prefer Nick Cave's version of it. And I have failed and failed at searching for those performances of Bertolt Brecht's songs by Johnny Cash. And as I was getting lost in one website after the other, I've been humming the verses of Surabaya Johnny, where Cash is mentioned. You only want Cash, Johnny, etc. But what Johnny Cash didn't do, Eric Bentley did before him.
I was just past my 16th birthday when you dropped in one day from the blue, and to say to come with you to Burma and to leave all the fixing to you. I asked you what job you were doing, and I swear that you answered to me you had something to do with the railway and nothing to do with the sea. You talked a lot, Johnny. A lot of lies, Johnny. You took me for a ride, Johnny, all along the line. And I hate you so, Johnny. You're grinning there, Johnny. Just take that damn pipe out of your mouth, you swine. Lullaby, Johnny, done the worst that you know. Lullaby, Johnny, oh God, and I love you so. Tour of a journey. Where can I hide or go? You have no heart, Johnny, and I do love you so. Zuerst war es immer Sonntag. Das war, bis ich mitging mit dir. Aber dann schon nach zwei Wochen war die nicht mehr recht an mir. Hinauf und hinab durch den Punch-Up, den Fluss entlang bis zur See. Ich sehe schon aus im Spiegel wie eine 40-Jährige. Du wolltest nicht Liebe, Johnny. Du wolltest doch nur Geld, Johnny. Ich aber sah, Johnny, nur auf deinen Mund. Du verlangtest alles, Johnny. Ich gab dir mehr, Johnny. Ach, nimm doch die verdammte Pfeife aus deinem Maul, du Hund.
In 1971, another outstanding document was published, which brought Bentley's more rigorous scholarly side back to the forefront. This time taking a book form, the volume 30 Years of Treason encapsulated about 1,000 pages of transcripts from the hearings before the HUAC during the period 1938-1968. I am sure the specific weight of that 30-year stretch will be immediately felt by most of you. Most witnesses, friendly and unfriendly, were artists and intellectuals. But Eric Bentley never was one of them, certainly because critics are not considered dangerous, and he lived on and kept recording. He wrote more books on Brecht, the famous Brecht memoir, and Bentley on Brecht, the latter bearing the same title as his recording of Brechtian songs and poems from the 1960s. I should say I found in Eric Bentley's 1963 edition of the hearings of Bertolt Brecht before the HUAC a missing link in the genealogy of our symposium. And in the figure of Eric Bentley himself, a model of scholarship on the recorded sound media. Eric Bentley has been something like an aesthetic guerrilla of one. He has ambushed theater audiences from all sorts of corners, jumping from stage to blackboard, from blackboard to cabaret, from the written to the oral and beyond. He befriended Brecht, translated Brecht, sang Brecht, examined, taught, read, impersonated Brecht. The critic is not far from the ventriloquist, indeed.
I, Bertolt Brecht, come from the Black Forests. My mother took me to the cities while I lay inside her. The coldness of the forests will be with me till my dying day. The asphalt cities are my home. From the very first, they supplied me with every last sacrament. Newspapers, tobacco, brandy. Suspicious, lazy, and when all said, content. I am friendly with people. I stick a stiff hat on my head as they do. They are beasts, I say, with a particular odor. So what? I also say, I am too. In the morning sometimes I take some girls and sit them in my empty armchairs, whereupon I look them nonchalantly over and declare, in me you have a man on whom you can't rely. Toward evening I gather some fellows around me. We address each other as gentlemen. They put their feet up on my table and remark, things will improve. I don't ask when. Toward morning, in the gray of dawn, the pines are pissing, and their bugs, the birds, begin to weep. In the city, I empty my glass, throw away my cigar stub, and go unhappily to sleep. We have been living a light generation in houses that were thought beyond destruction. the lanky buildings of Manhattan Island, and the fine antennae that amuse the Atlantic Ocean are of our construction. Of these cities will remain that which blew through them, the wind. A full pantry rejoices the guests, and they eat it bare. Our tenancy, we know, is transient, and after us will follow nothing worth a dare. As for the earthquakes to come, when they ask me if I will get bitter and let my cigar go out, I answer no. I, Bertolt Brecht, who came from the black forests to the asphalt cities inside my mother long ago.
The exact date of this recording is not more uncertain than the date of the poem. From any day in 1925 to any day in 1965, the rings of time are like rings of smoke coming out of Bertolt Brecht's cigar. Maybe we should start this program at least as many times as it carries circles of recorded memory, making it a collection of false starts. As I speak, I am trying to get a smoke ring through the microphone, counting rings that may in fact be an alternate title to this program, although we already made the hard choice of titling it Hearing Hearings, I mean the Hear Rings. This title does not quite do justice to what will be presented, as we will not only listen to the hearings of the Un-American Activities Committee, but also to a good deal of reading and singing and breathing.
Born in 1898, Bertolt Brecht was old enough to take part in the First World War. Before he actually took part in the war, he had been quite a patriotic boy. As a 16-year-old, he had written nationalistic poetry. But by 1918, he composed one of the notable anti-war poems of this century, Legend of the Dead Soldier. It is said to have passed from soldier to soldier without even being written down, spreading a very healthy defeatism. Spring came and still the war made ne'er a pause for breath. The soldier who knew what a soldier's for died a hero's death. But war for battle's a synonym, and the Kaiser was most upset that his soldier had gone and died on him. He shouldn't have done that yet. Without the Kaiser's permission, though, the summer rolled in like a wave. Then came a medical commission, oh, to that young soldier's grave.
In a statement prepared for the Un-American Activities Committee, Bertolt Brecht claimed that the song we just listened to was the main reason for his expatriation from Hitler's Germany in 1933. As an exile, Brecht often imagine dialogues of expats and migrants as concrete manifestations of the historical spirit. He dreamed of a wisdom that belonged to the land and its communities like a fruit tree or a fountainhead. But his standpoint on that land was that of the wanderer, the stowaway. He thought of his fellow poets as stowaways, also as they traveled on the ship of death or sojourned in the refugee camps of purgatory. He was right if he considered Du Fu as the most notable poet of all time, but he certainly had more success than Du Fu, even in exile.
To the exiled poets. When in a dream he entered the hut of the exiled poets, which is next to the hut where the exiled teachers live, from the latter he heard quarreling and laughter, Ovid came to meet him in the doorway and said in an undertone, "You'd better not sit down now, you're not dead yet. Who knows, you might still go back and without anything having changed except you." But with comfort in his eyes, Po Chui approached and said with a smile, "Anyone who is called injustice by its name as often as once will get what's coming to him." And his friend Tu Fu quietly added, "Exile, you understand, is not a place where pride is unlearned." Earthier than these, the tattered Villon approached and asked, "The house you live in, how many doors has it?" And Dante took him aside, and grasping him by the sleeve, he murmured, "Your verses bristle with mistakes, my friend. Think of all your enemies." And from the other side of the hall, Voltaire shouted, "Look after your pennies, or they'll starve you to death." "And work a few jokes in," cried Heine. "That won't help," Shakespeare complained. "When James came to the throne, even I wasn't allowed to write." "If they put you on trial, get a crook for your attorney," said Euripides. "He'll know the holes in the net of the law." The laughter was still resounding through the place when from the farthest corner came a cry, "You, newcomer, do they know your verses by heart too? And those who do, will they escape punishment?" "It is the forgotten," said Dante softly. "Not only their bodies, their works too were destroyed." The laughter stopped. None dared to look. The newcomer had turned pale.
And as an exile, Brecht always carried a radio with him.
The song I'm now going to sing is called "To the Little Radio." Oh, little box I carried in my flight, so's not to break the radio tubes inside me. From house to boat, from boat to train, held tight, so that my enemies could still address me. Right where I slept, and much to my dismay, last thing at night and first thing every day, about their victories, defeats for me. Oh, please do not fall silent suddenly.
Tonight's program, a double feature, which in other words means a half program, is not titled "Counting Smoke Rings," but rather "Hearing Hearings." With the phrase "Hearing Hearings," I would like to propose that we place ourselves beside those endearing investigators that interrogated Brecht in that October of 1947. Let us be the glass of water near the microphone, the gadfly on the wall of the card room, the lamp over the chairman's toupee. But there is an added meaning to this title, "Hearing Hearings." The deposition of Bertolt Brecht before the HUAC that you will soon hear was not recorded directly at the courtroom, but somewhere else by means of a radio receiver. As Eric Bentley explains, the sessions of the HUAC were not recorded, but they were broadcast on national radio. Someone, we suppose, friendly to Brecht's cause and aware of the significance of the event of his public interrogation, someone with some equipment, we assume, recorded this event live while it was being broadcast somewhere else, recording from the elsewhere, which is more or less where we are right now. Bertolt Brecht himself had this recording and played it for Eric Bentley a year or so later in Zurich. And now you are about to hear those hearings on radio, adding a new circle to this accumulation of concentric smoke rings.
This is the voice of Eric Bentley speaking to you from the studios of Folkways Records in the spring of 1963. Between the 20th and 30th of October 1947, the Committee on Un-American Activities of the House of Representatives held some, quote, hearings regarding the communist infiltration of the motion picture industry, unquote. The chairman of the committee was J. Parnell Thomas of New Jersey, and among its members were several men who either were or would later be famous, such as Richard M. Nixon of California, Carl E. Mundt of South Dakota, and John E. Rankin of Mississippi. Among the witnesses called during that 10-day period were Jack L. Warner, Louis B. Mayer, Ayn Rand, Adolphe Monjou, Robert Taylor, Robert Montgomery, Ronald Reagan, Gary Cooper, Walt Disney, John Howard Lawson, Dalton Trumbo, Albert Maltz, Alva Bessie, Samuel Ornitz, Herbert Biberman, Emmett Lavery, Edward Dmytryk, Adrian Scott, Dor Sherry, Ring Lardner Jr., and Lester Cole. We have subpoenaed witnesses, Mr. Thomas said, representing both sides of the question, and the testimony duly turned out to be chiefly of two kinds. One group of witnesses spoke against communism and named persons in Hollywood whom they regarded as communists. The other pleaded the Fifth Amendment and maintained that the investigation was improper. The second group would later get jail sentences for contempt of Congress. But one or two witnesses stood outside both the groups. Dor Sherry is an example. Another is Emmett Lavery, who stated a social philosophy close to that of Pope John XXIII's encyclicals of the 1960s. The witness who stood furthest apart from the others was Bertolt Brecht, whose testimony you are now about to hear. The scene of this Brechtian tragicomedy is the crowded caucus room of the old House office building, Washington, D.C. The date is Thursday, October the 30th, 1947. Present are only three members of the committee, Parnell Thomas, John McDowell of Pennsylvania, and Richard B. Vail of Illinois. With them is Robert E. Stripling, chief investigator. Bertolt Brecht is accompanied by two attorneys, Bartley Crum and Robert W. Kenny. The voice first announcing Bertolt Brecht's name is that of Stripling. The voice asking Brecht to stand is that of Parnell Thomas. Most of the questions afterwards and throughout the session are put by Stripling.
Bertolt Brecht. Mr. Brecht, will you stand, please, and raise your right hand? You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Sit down, please.
Mr. Brecht, will you please state your full name and present address for the record, please? Speak into the microphone.
My name is Bertolt Brecht. I'm living at 34 West 73rd Street, New York. I'm born in Augsburg, Germany, February 10th, 1898.
Mr. Brecht, the committee has a...
What was that date again?
Would you give the date again?
10th of February, 1898.
Mr. Chairman, the committee has here an interpreter, if you desire, the use of an interpreter.
Thank you. Would you like an interpreter? You desire an interpreter?
Yes. I thank you. When you could help me when I need to.
An interpreter named David Baumgart is seated beside Brecht.
Where are you employed, Mr. Baumgart?
The Library of Congress.
He's the one who's going to be doing the talking.
Mr. Chairman, may I read a statement in English?
Yes, but has the chief investigator completed his identification of both the interpreter and the witness?
No, sir, I have not. Now, Mr. Breck, will you state to the committee whether or not you are a citizen of the United States?
I'm not a citizen of the United States. I have states. I have only my first papers.
Now, when did you acquire your first papers?
In 41, when I came into the country.
When did you arrive in the United States?
May I? I arrived in July 21st at San Pedro.
July the 21st, 1941?
That's right.
At San Pedro, California?
Yeah.
You were born in Augsburg, Bavaria, Germany on February the 10th, 1888, is that correct?
Yeah.
I'm reading from the immigration records.
Yeah.
19. Beg pardon? I think the witness said tried to say 19. Yes, I wondered if whether or not the immigration records were correct in that. Or is it 98? 98. Were you issued a quota immigration visa by the American Vice Consul on May 3rd, 1941 at Helsinki, Finland?
That's correct.
You entered this country on that visa?
Yeah.
Where had you resided prior to going to Helsinki, Finland?
May I read my statement? In that statement I have...
First, Mr. Breck, we're trying to identify you. The identification won't be very long.
I had to leave Germany 33 in February when Hitler took power. Then I went to Denmark, but when war seemed imminent, then 39 I had to leave for Sweden, Stockholm. I remained there for 1 year. Then Hitler invaded Norway and Denmark, and I had to leave Sweden, and I went to Finland there to wait for my visa for the United States.
Now, Mr. Breck, what is your occupation?
I am a playwright and a poet.
Playwright and poet?
Yeah.
Where are you presently employed?
I'm not employed.
Were you ever employed in the motion picture industry?
Yeah. I sold a story to a Hollywood firm. Hangman also died, but I did not write the screenplay myself. I'm not a professional screenplay writer. I wrote another story for a Hollywood firm, but that story was not produced.
Credit for the screenplay of Hangman Also Die went to John Wexley.
The Hangman Also Die, who did you sell that to? What studio?
That was to, an independent firm, Pressburger, at the United Artists.
United Artists?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with Hans Eisler or Johannes Eisler?
Yeah.
With this, it becomes clear that Bertolt Brecht's presence in Washington had less to do with American writers from Hollywood than with an even more celebrated case. In September 1947, the German communist Gerhard Eisler had been brought before this committee. J. Edgar Hoover had reported that he had been the representative of the Communist International to the Communist Party of the USA. Eisler's sister, Ruth Fisher, denounced him before the committee as a leading agent of the Russian secret police. "I regard him as a most dangerous terrorist," she said. "I consider Eisler the perfect terrorist type, conditioned to hand over to the GPU his child, his sister, his closest friend." Unquote. There followed a lengthy questioning by the committee of the composer Hans Eisler, brother of Gerhard and Ruth. The Hans Eisler material in the committee's printed records fills more than 200 pages. It also only narrowly missed creating the biggest national scandal since the Teapot Dome scandals, for it was made to seem possible that Mrs. Roosevelt's name was involved in conspiracy. She had had something to do with getting Hans Eisler a visa, and Hans Eisler had a great deal to do with the international communist movement. The published transcript is illustrated with photographs showing Eisler leading Russian children in song, Eisler giving the clenched fist salute and whatnot. One name that was bound to come up was that of Bertolt Brecht, whose words Hans Eisler had often set to music. The committee had a complete translation made of the Brecht-Eisler oratorio, The Measures Taken, and wrote it into the record. Gerhard Eisler was convicted of contempt of Congress and of passport violations. Hans Eisler, having been arrested, was out on bond awaiting a hearing on a deportation order. It was at this interesting point in time that Mr. Stripling put the question, how long have you known Johannes Eisler?
How long have you known Johannes Eisler?
I think since the middle of the 20s. 20 years or so.
Have you collaborated with him on a number of works?
Yeah.
Mr. Breck, are you a member of the Communist Party, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
May I read my statement? I'll answer this question. May I read, but may I read my statement?
Would you submit your statement to the chairman, please?
Parnell Thomas looked over the statement and made the following comment.
Mr. Breck, the committee is carefully going over this statement. It's a very interesting story of German life, but it's not at all pertinent to this inquiry. Therefore, we do not care to have you read the statement.
The statement Brecht was not allowed to read was as follows. I was born in Augsburg, Germany, the son of an industrialist, and studied natural science and philosophy at the universities of Munich and Berlin. At the age of 20, when participating in the war as a member of the medical corps, I wrote a ballad which the Hitler government used 15 years later as the reason for my expatriation. The poem, Legend of a Dead Soldier, attacked the war and those wanting to prolong it. I became a playwright. For a time, Germany seemed to be on the path of democracy. There was freedom of speech and artistic expression. In the second half of the 1920s, however, the old reactionary militarist forces began to regain strength. I was then at the height of my career as a playwright, my play The Threepenny Opera being produced all over Europe. But in Germany, voices could already be heard demanding that free artistic expression and free speech should be silenced. Humanist, socialist, even Christian ideas were called undeutsch, un-German, a word which I hardly can think of without Hitler's wolfish intonation. At the same time, the cultural and political institutions of the people were attacked. The Weimar Republic, whatever its faults, had a powerful slogan accepted by the best writers, Die Kunst dem Volke, art to the people. The German workers, their interest in art being great indeed, formed a highly important part of the general public. Their sufferings in a devastating depression, which threatened their cultural standards, the impudence and growing power of the old militarist feudal imperialist gang alarmed us all. I started writing poems, songs, and plays reflecting the feelings of the people and attacking their enemies who now marched under the swastika of Hitler. Persecutions in the field of culture increased. Famous painters, publishers, and distinguished editors were persecuted. At the universities, political witch hunts were staged, and campaigns were waged against pictures such as All Quiet on the Western Front. These, of course, were only preparations for more drastic measures. When Hitler seized power, painters were forbidden to paint, publishing houses and film studios were taken over by the Nazi Party. But even these strokes against the cultural life of the German people were only the beginning. They were designed as a spiritual preparation for total war, which is the total enemy of all culture. The war put on the finishing touch. The German people now have to live without roofs over their heads, without sufficient food, without soap, without the foundations of culture. In the beginning, only a few were capable of seeing the connection between reactionary restrictions in the field of culture and the ultimate assault upon the physical life of a people. The efforts of the democratic anti-militaristic forces, of which those in the cultural field were, of course, only a small part, proved to be weak indeed. Hitler took over, I had to leave Germany in February 1933, the day following the Reichstag fire. A veritable exodus of writers and artists began, of a kind such as the world had never seen before. I settled in Denmark and dedicated my total literary production from that time on to the struggle against Nazism. Some poems were smuggled into the Third Reich, and Danish Nazism, supported by Hitler's embassy, began to demand my deportation. Of course, the Danish government refused, but in 1939, when war seemed imminent, I left with my family for Sweden, invited by Swedish senators and the mayor of Stockholm. I could stay only a year. Hitler invaded Denmark and Norway. We continued our flight northward to Finland, there to wait for an immigration visa to the USA. Hitler's troops followed. Finland was full of Nazi divisions when we left for the United States in 1941. We crossed the USSR by the Siberian Express, which carried German, Austrian, Czechoslovak refugees. 10 days after our leaving Vladivostok aboard a Swedish ship, Hitler invaded the USSR. During the voyage, the ship loaded copra in Manila. Some months later, Hitler's allies would invade that island. We applied for American citizenship, first papers, that is, on the day following Pearl Harbor. I suppose that some poems and plays of mine written during this period of the fight against Hitler have moved the Un-American Activities Committee to subpoena me. My activities, even those against Hitler, have always been purely literary and of a strictly independent nature. As a guest of the United States, I refrain from political activities concerning this country, even in a literary form. By the way, I am not a screenwriter. Hollywood used only one story of mine for a picture showing the Nazi savagery in Prague. I am not aware of any influence which I could have exercised in the movie industry, whether political or artistic. Being called before the Un-American Activities Committee, however, I feel free for the first time to say a word or two about American matters. Looking back at my experiences as a playwright and a poet in the Europe of the last 2 decades, I wish to say that the great American people would lose much and risk much if they allowed anyone to restrict the free competition in ideas in cultural fields, or to interfere with art, which must be free in order to be art. We live in a dangerous world. Mankind is capable of becoming enormously wealthy, but as a whole is still poverty-stricken. Great wars have been suffered. We are told greater ones are imminent. One of them might well wipe out mankind. We may be the last generation of the species man. Ideas of how to make use of the new capabilities of production have not been much developed since the days when the horse had to do what man could not do. Now, do you not think that in such a predicament, every new idea should be examined carefully and freely? Art can present such ideas clearly and even ennoble them. The hearing continued as follows.
Now, I'll repeat the original question. Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party of any country?
Mr. Chairman, I have heard my colleagues and they considered this question not as proper, but I am a guest in this country and do not want to enter in any legal arguments, so I will answer your question fully as well I can. I am not a member of any Communist Party.
You mentioned that you have never been a member of the Communist Party.
That is correct.
You were not a member of the Communist Party for Germany?
No, I was not.
Mr. Breck, is it true that you have written a number of very revolutionary poems, plays, and other writings?
I have written a number of poems and songs and plays in the fight against Hitler, and of course they can be considered therefore as revolutionary, because I of course was for the overthrow of that government.
But Mr. Griffin, we're not interested in any works that he might have written calling for the overthrow of Germany.
Yes,
or the government there.
Well, from an examination of the works which Mr. Breck has written, particularly in collaboration with Mr. Hans Eisler, he seems to be a person of international importance to the communist revolutionary movement. Now, Mr. Breck, is it true, or do you know whether or not you have written articles for which have been...
There's going to be another fall here pretty soon, so will you boys just sit down quietly, please, before we're...
Go ahead.
Have you written articles which have appeared in publications in the Soviet zone of Germany within the past few months?
I do not remember to have written such articles. I have not seen any of them printed. I have not written such articles just now. I write very few articles, if any.
I have here, Mr. Chairman, a document which I'll hand to the translator and ask him to identify it for the committee and to refer to an article which appears on page 72.
When did you write that? Oh, may I speak to that publication?
Beg pardon?
May I explain this?
Yes, we want to identify the publication.
Oh, yes. That is not an article. That is a scene out of a play I wrote in, I think, 1937 or 1938 in Denmark. The play is called Private Life of the Master Race, and this scene is one of the scenes out of this play about a Jewish woman in Berlin in the year of 36 or 37. It was, I see, printed in this magazine Ost und West.
And in fact, The Private Life of the Master Race had been presented in New York in 45, complete with the Jewish wife scene.
Mr. Translator, would you translate the front piece of the magazine, please?
East and West, contributions to cultural and political questions of the time, edited by Alfred Kantorowicz.
How do you spell it?
K-A-N-T-O-R-O-W-I-C-Z. Berlin, July 1947, first year of publication and price.
Kantorowicz was a communist or communist sympathizer at that time. In 1956, he was to break with the communists and flee from East to West Germany.
Mr. Breck, do you know the gentleman who is the editor of the publication whose name was just read?
Yes, I know him from Berlin, and I met him in New York again.
You know him to be a member of the Communist Party of Germany?
When I met him in Germany, I think he was a journalist in the Ulstein Press, that is a Not a communist, was not communist, there were no communist organ papers. So I do not know exactly whether he was a member of the Communist Party of Germany.
You don't know whether he was a member of the Communist Party or not?
I don't know, no. I don't know.
In 1930, did you with Hans Eisler write a play entitled D-I-E capital M-A-S-S-N-A-H-M-E?
Die Maßnahme.
Did you write such a play?
Yes, yes.
Would you explain to the committee the theme of that play? What it dealt with?
Yeah, I tried to.
First, explain what the title means.
Die Maßnahme means
measures to be taken, steps to be taken.
Could it mean disciplinary measures?
Not disciplinary measures, no. It means only measures to be taken.
Speak into the microphone.
It means only measures or steps to be taken.
All right. You tell the committee now, Mr.
Yeah.
Breck, what this play dealt with.
Yeah. This play is the adaptation of an old religious Japanese play, so-called no play, and follows quite closely this old story, which shows the devotion for an ideal until death.
What was that idea, Mr. Breck?
The idea in the old play was a religious ideas. Pupils, young people.
Didn't it have to do with the Communist Party?
Yes, it's
discipline within the Communist Party.
Yes, yes, a new play, the adaptation. Had as a background Russia, China of the 18 or so. Some communist agitators went to the Russia, which then was not a state and had no real...
Mr. Breck, may I interrupt you? Would
yes.
you consider the play to be pro-communist or anti-communist? Or did it take a neutral position regarding communism?
No. I would say... You see, literature has the right and the duty to give to the public the ideas of the time. Now in this play, of course I wrote about 20 plays, but in this play I tried to express the feelings and the ideas of the German workers who then fought against Hitler. I also formulated in a artistic, but in a positive
Hitler.
Way.
Fighting against Hitler, did you say?
Yeah.
Written in 1930.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. That fight started 23.
You say it's about China, though. It has nothing to do with Germany?
No, it has nothing
Let
to
do
directly with
Let me read some of the excerpts from it.
Yeah.
Throughout the play, reference is made in a laudatory fashion to the teachings of Lenin, the, quote, ABC of communism, end quote, and the activities of Chinese Communist Party in general. The following are excerpts from the play. The four agitators, quote, we came from Moscow as agitators. We were to travel the city of Mukden to spread propaganda and to create in the factories the Chinese Party. We were to report to party headquarters closest to the border and to requisition a guide. There in the anteroom, a young comrade came toward us and spoke of the nature of our mission. We are repeating the conversation. the young comrade. I am the secretary of the party headquarters, which is the last towards the border. My heart is beating for the revolution. The witnessing of wrongdoing drove me into the lines of the fighters. Man must help man. I am for freedom. I believe in mankind, and I am for the rules of the Communist Party, which fights for the classless society against exploitation and ignorance. The two of us have to defend the revolution here. Surely you have a letter to us from the Central Committee which tells us what to do. The three agitators. So it is, we bring you nothing, but across the border, the muckin we bring to the Chinese workers, the teachings of the classics and of the propagandists, the ABC of communism, to the ignorant the truth about their situation, to the oppressed class conscious, and to the class conscious the experience of revolution. From you, we shall requisition an automobile and a guide. The four agitators. We went as Chinese to muckin, four men and a woman, to spread propaganda and to create the Chinese party throughout the teachings of the classics of the propagandists, the ABC of communism, to bring truth to the ignorant about their situation, the oppressed, class conscious, the experience of the revolution. The individual has two. The party has 1,000 eyes. The party sees 7 states. The party has many hours. The party cannot be destroyed, for it fights with the methods of the classics, which are drawn from the knowledge of reality and are destined to be changed in that the teaching spread through the masses. Who, however, is the party? It is sitting in a house with telephones, and its thoughts secrets, its resolutions unknown. Who is it? It is all of us. We are the party. You and I, all of you, all of us. In your sweet, it is comrade. In your head it thinks, wherever I live, there it is home, and wherever you are attacked, there it fights.
The translation is close enough to the German. It is Mr. Stripling's way of reading it that makes it hard to follow. He says sweet for suit, class conscious for class consciousness, it is for is it, and so on. He also skips from page to page without saying so. Sometimes he doubles back without saying so. Let me refer anyone who wishes to read The Measures Taken Properly to the full text as now published in my own collection, The Modern Theater. The point here is that Stripling had quizzed Hans Eisler on The Measures Taken a month earlier, and that Hans Eisler said the play was about the murder of a communist by 3 other communists, and that the title could be translated The Disciplinary Measure.